It's the most all-star studded challenge ever. And this time, it's every competitor for themselves.
Best challenge ever!
The Challenge All-Stars. New season now streaming on Paramount Plus. Go to ParamountPlus.com to try it free. Terms apply.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Tunnel Vision, a show brought to you by USCFootball.com. I'm your host, Keely Orr, joined by Ryan Abraham and Shotgun Spratling. We have a fun show for you guys today. We have a lot to talk about. The NFL draft wrapped up. Five Trojans drafted, all seven signed, so we'll get into that. And, of course, the conclusion of USC's 2021 spring camp. We'll share our takes, our observations, our overall thoughts from the last 5 weeks of USC football practice, which we got to see, which is fun, so we'll talk about that. I'll also talk about some of the ramifications from camp, or at least what we'll watch for going forward, like USC's offensive line competition. We got to hear from Clay Helton on Friday about that, so we'll get into that. As always, you can call us 5124-TUNNEL. We love hearing from you guys. You can also put your tweet. I can put up your tweet if you put hashtag TunnelVision. And wherever you're watching, I believe we are live on all three platforms, YouTube, Facebook, and whatever Periscope Twitter version is right now. We're live on that as well. So be sure to put your comments and your questions. We love hearing from you guys. But guys, like I said, a lot of football news this past week, so it's a good show to have.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. There's the end of USC spring football practice 2021, 5 weeks right in a row. We went to practice on Friday. They did another full pads practice, and Shotgun was counting them up, those full pads practices. Didn't think we were going to see full pads on the last day. We did. It was shorter, about an hour, but we got to see some tackling, some full hitting stuff, so that was cool. Clay Helton gave him a break after the three horns we hear that ended in practice after an hour. It's like, well, that's kind of quick. But also the NFL draft, and three days of that was sort of like bookend with, a first round draft pick on day one, nothing on day two, and then four guys selected on day three with a couple of free agent signings. So all seven guys that were invited to the virtual NFL combine this year, all of them ended up on some NFL team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so congrats to them. It's always cool to see those guys transition to the next level. But let's get into, the NFL draft, your overall thoughts. First, any surprises, guys?
I mean, I think the biggest surprise for me was that Amon Ross St. Brown lasted as long as he did. Now, I feel like any time a fan of a program or someone who covers a team, you see a guy enough times and they're a quality player, you think, this guy's going to go a little bit higher in the draft than they end up doing. A lot of times you just feel like that kind of happens. But Amon Ross St. Brown, just how productive he was and how consistent of a player he is. I was a little surprised that he fell all the way to draft three. I mean, to day three of the draft. I expected him to go on day two in rounds two or three. But, him falling there, the Lions pick him up, and now he's going to be teammates with Penei Sewell, so a little Pac-12 reconnecting there.
A little Pac-12 action. Well, let me just run down what ended up happening. So Elijah Vera Tucker went in the first round. He was the 14th pick with the New York Jets. Jay Tufele went in the fourth round. He was the 106th overall pick, and he went to the Jacksonville Jaguars. Amon Ross St. Brown, like you said, Shotgun, fourth round pick 112 with the Detroit Lions. Tano Hufanga went in the fifth round. He was pick 180 with the 49ers. And then the last Trojan to get drafted was Marlon Tuipulotu. He went in the sixth round, and he was the 198th pick and went with the Eagles. And then Elijah Griffin was an undrafted free agent. He signed with the Buffalo Bills, and then Tyler Vaughn signed with the Colts, reuniting with Michael Pittman over there in Indianapolis. So a fun little Trojan wide receiver reunion over there.
I like with the Colts. Sorry, I was just pulling up the video stuff here. It was like little technical glitches, but I think we got all. So we should be able to put up your Facebook and YouTube comments and questions up on the screen. So I made sure that was working. I do like that. So what are the Colts doing? Andrew Luck retired a couple years ago, bringing in Carson Wentz. Is that kind of an interesting move there? But you have Michael Pittman and you have Tyler Vaughn's, you know, reunited. They were teammates before. So I think that'll be a really interesting pairing there. It's a, you know, I think it's a team that's got some young talent on there. And, you know, now you bring a young Trojan in there and he'll kind of add to the mix.
Now, it's kind of hindsight is 2020, and I know Jay Tufele had family COVID issues, so it's kind of understandable why he chose to opt out. But prior to him opting out, he was listed pretty high as far as mock drafts, and yet he went lower than I think what people expected. Do you think that was the right call ultimately for him to opt out, or is that something just above it all because family was involved?
I mean, this is the question that was argued probably the most in my mentions and on the timeline, going through the draft. And you can't fault him for opting out, especially after, you know, a serious family illness, you know, with his sister being on life support, being in the ICU. You know, that comes first. Family
yeah,
comes first.
Of course.
And obviously that played a large role, I think, factored into his decision heavily, I believe. But I think that he's going to be a steal. And I said this just from the way that when we talk to him, the way his body has changed, the maturity that he's, he showed when we talked to him, I think he's going to be a steal there. If he played, I think he would have made more plays and been more consistent in just another year, and playing under Vic Soto and the way the defensive line played this year, I think he would have had a chance to create some more hype around himself and be able to push his draft stock up higher. We saw that, you know, the opt-outs for people didn't necessarily hurt anyone of those top-end guys. But I think after that first group of, you know, five or so guys that were in the top 15 in the draft that opted out, I think you did see the rest of the opt-outs. I think it hurt. You know, if you weren't going to be one of those, if you weren't already a top 15 pick coming into the season, then I think the opt out hurts you because, you know, anyone that, you know, that's after that 15, you know, if you're not seen as, you know, a generational type of talent at a certain position in that top five, top 10, then after that, you're seen as a really good player that could be, you know, become a first round draft pick. Well, teams don't want to waste a first round draft pick. They're so scared of missing on that first round draft pick because it's so valuable and you're paying them a good amount of money that I think those type of guys slid a little bit more. So Jay Tufele, a guy that maybe could have worked his way into being a first round draft pick in between 20 and 30, I think he slid down draft boards because teams didn't get a chance to see him, perform on the field this season. So I think, yeah, he definitely was hurt by opting out, but I don't think you can fault him at all with the situation that was there.
That makes sense.
I don't fault them either. And, you know, if you look at the Pac-12, they had three first-round draft picks. All were opt-outs. Elijah Vertucker is the only one that came back. So Penny Sewell, Joe Tryon, they didn't play. And, you know, Jay Tufele ended up being the second Trojan selected. So, I mean, if Amon-Ra St. Brown sat out, you would say, oh, he fell. He wouldn't go in the second day because he opted out. Well, he played, you know, he played and played well and still dropped there. So I think it's hard to say. You're like, oh, yeah, that really hurt. I think that's kind of a stretch right now, but you know, it didn't seem to hurt a lot of people. If you needed more tape, fine. But the fact that he was the second Trojan off the board after Elijah Vera Tucker, I don't think it would hurt him that much.
Mm-hmm. Now, looking back, I remember we were all a little surprised that Elijah Griffin decided to declare, and he went unsigned. He did sign with the Bills, but undrafted. But he's a guy who had 25 appearances as a Trojan, 15 starts. Do you feel like he should have had more time as a Trojan?
I mean, he would have benefited from coming back another year. There was no doubt when he made the announcement that I thought the same thing, and then he goes undrafted. However, can he still make it in the NFL? I think he goes to Buffalo, and maybe he follows the same path as Nickell Robey-Coleman, you know, another guy who went undrafted after, you know, leaving early and has turned it into a, 8-9-year career now in the NFL. So I think that Elijah Griffin has the talent and potential to do that. However, he could have, if he came back another year, I think he definitely could have risen his stock. And the fact that Dante Williams has continued to develop players, you know, he had three DBs, I believe, from Oregon that were drafted in this draft that he had coached up prior to coming to USC. So I think that tells you that Elijah Griffin, you know, coming out of high school, was he rated similar to Diamador Lenore and Thomas Graham? You know, I think he was higher than both of those guys. So, yeah, I think another year with Dante Williams would have helped, you know, helped him develop as a player and boosted his draft stock for next year. But I still think that he's going to make the team in an NFL environment. Maybe not initially, but down the road he'll make a team and he'll probably stick around for a few years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he'll make the team, but I think he would have helped himself for sure. That's one of those situations where people, you know, and, you know, having a famous dad, maybe there's famous people in your ear, oh, he's going to come out. And I think, you know, Warren G was saying he was going to be a second or third rounder. And, you know, obviously that wasn't the case. You know, not these are, you know, young guys. They're not going to get the best advice all the time. And, you know, who knows? He could have, if all it took was one team. If one team would have selected him, that's fine. That didn't end up happening. But it seemed like, you know, another year for Elijah Griffin would have been good. Get a little more seasoning and give yourself an opportunity. Be a stud. Be an absolute star for this Trojan defense. Would look like it was going to be better for a full season. And I think that probably would have helped his stock.
And the weird thing, too, that happened is that he was diagnosed with COVID right before USC's Pro Day, which was essentially the combine.
Yeah.
How much did that impact things? Because if you have all scouts there, maybe you catch someone's eye, but you're having your own individual combine day or Pro Day.
Yeah.
It seems like that also impacted him at some point.
Yeah, that happened. I think some people went to it. I didn't. I mean, I don't know if any of us ended up going
we
that
did not.
Day. Yeah. So that's one of those things, like, we didn't cover it. So, yeah, you're probably not getting a lot of NFL people there. So didn't help. I mean, I don't think that helped. Obviously,
sure.
You know, it sucks that, you know, hopefully he's healthy and he gets COVID and stuff. But that you know, timing for that, not great.
Yeah, not great at all.
Yeah, definitely, because that, like Kitty said, that's a chance to catch someone's eye that's not there to see you.
Yeah.
Versus, I mean, if Elijah Vera Tucker did it, yeah, teams are going to come back and everyone's going to come and watch him because they want to see the first-round talents, anyone that's looking for an offensive lineman. You know, if Elijah Griffin, if you've already got your board and he's 25 on the cornerback rankings, you know, are you going to invest a flight from Buffalo or something to come where he ends up? Or, you know, are the Jets going to fly out to see him if they're not really looking for a cornerback? You know, I think that makes it that much more difficult for him to be seen by someone who maybe wasn't necessarily looking for that position to begin with.
Mm-hmm. We got a question from AKA Boone Ryan for you. He said, are you surprised that your boy Tyler Vaughns didn't get drafted?
I thought he'd be like a, you know, there would be like a sixth, seventh round kind of thing, or, you know, undrafted free agent. So, not, I mean, it's not a huge surprise. Seeing that Amon-Ra St. Brown didn't go in round two or three, just that day two of the draft was sort of like a, I don't know, maybe like a little reality slap or something. You're like, oh, I thought, you know, maybe there's some opportunities for guys to go in the second or third round. And when none of them did, you kind of felt like, at least I felt like, everyone's probably going to drop down a little bit. Now, you know, getting the first pick of round four, that's nice. You know, Jay Toffoli goes off right away. And, you know, seeing Amon-Ra St. Brown going, you know, just a few picks after that, that was nice. But Amon-Ra St. Brown being a fourth rounder, you kind of felt like, okay, Tyler Vaughn's probably going to be an undrafted free agent. I don't know what you thought, Shotgun.
I mean, the thing with Tyler Vaughns is the questions that were there were going to be there next year, so I don't think coming back would have changed anything for him. He's not he doesn't have the speed that NFL teams are looking for. He doesn't have, you know, the thickness that they're looking for from the big-bodied receivers on the outside. But he's productive. So he's a guy that's going to have to work his way up. And that was kind of expected from the beginning. I didn't expect him to be drafted. I thought he would be an undrafted free agent. Now, you know, priority undrafted free agent maybe, and finding the right fit, that's going to be the key for him. Now, he goes to Indianapolis. Having Pittman there, I'm sure, helps. You know, just to be able to get the lingo. He can say, you know, this concept is similar to the one we ran, you know, at USC called this.
Yeah.
You know, that helps. You know, those type things help. But also being there and having T.Y. Hilton, you know, another veteran, you know, having the veteran receiver there that can, you know, if he's making his mark and working his way up and, you know, he does make the team, makes the training camp, does those type things. And T.Y. Hilton, if he is impressive there, and T.Y. Hilton brings him over and says, starts giving him pointers and stuff, that's a good fit for him potentially there. And it just comes down to production. You know, I remember last year writing about the Colts and how Pittman fit in there, and they really haven't had a second receiver outside of T.Y. Hilton, you know, basically since the Marvin Harrison, Reggie Wayne days. Like, once T.Y. Hilton became the secondary receiver for Reggie Wayne, and once Wayne left, they really haven't had a guy that fit in. They tried different, you know, guys, and that was the hope for Pittman, which tells me that, you know, there's potential, there's a possibility there that he could work his way up there, because no one stood out, you know, just from my recollection off the Colts roster from last year that stepped up and just had a big year at the wide receiver position or anything.
Yeah, I remember covering Pittman getting drafted, and all the Colts fans in the mentions were like, can he catch the ball? Can he catch it, please? Seems like they're in need of some wide receivers in that sense.
And if good with Tyler Vaughn's, if you're going to come to a place that has an established quarterback that had a long-time relationship with T.Y. Hilton and Michael Pittman, that's his guys, right? They're going to have that. Now you got a new quarterback. Like, all of the guys are going to be new to him. So Tyler Vaughn's is as new as Michael Pittman or T.Y. Hilton is, even though those guys have been around a little while. He's as new as those guys. So maybe some opportunities there.
Mm-hmm.
And he probably could have benefited from – you know, if he would have come in last year, the fact that Pittman came in last year, just that extra year with a Hall of Famer like Phillip Rivers, you know, learning from a quarterback like that. Now it's going to be different with Carson Wentz. But like you said, you know, it's a new quarterback. It's a new system for him. He's going to find his new favorites. It's not like he's got everyone established already in certain roles in his mind.
Mm-hmm. Vaughn's might catch a pass in some offseason workout and he's like, that's my guy. You know, who knows?
Oh, so you're saying Carson Wentz is the new Ryan Abraham?
Yeah. Yeah, I was about to say.
Carson, give me a call. Let's go.
Talanoa Hufanga with the 49ers. How do you guys think he fits in there?
And the NFC West is just going to be so much fun to watch.
Okay.
I mean, all four teams are really talented, and you can see any of them winning. You can see any of those teams representing the NFC in the Super Bowl next year. You know, it wouldn't be surprising to see any of those. Maybe a little bit Arizona, but they're super talented, and they have been really fun to watch with Kyler Murray and Cliff Kingsbury and the pieces that they've been adding to there. So Talanoa Hufanga, he's going to be chasing down Kyler Murray. He's going to be chasing down Russell Wilson. How's that going to fit? He doesn't really have to chase Matthew Stafford as much. But, you know, going to be chasing those two guys. So that's going to be fun to watch. There's several Trojans in the NFC West. So it's going to be a fun division to watch games of. You know, if you're watching the Seahawks and you're watching Rasheem Green, you're watching the Rams, you're seeing Robert Woods. So, you know, it's going to be fun to watch those Devon Kennard with Arizona. So, you know, for a USC fan, you should be able to have a vested interest in any NFC West game.
Yeah, the 49ers are going to be a team to watch, obviously. They make a big trade. You give up a couple first-rounders. You move up to number three to take a dude that had 17 starts that wasn't even in the FBS. You know, like, that's pretty crazy. He looks like he's got a lot of upside, but it was a big risk with that first pick. And you're not going to have first-round picks for the next couple of years. And like Shotgun said, you're going to be chasing around some quarterbacks, a lot of good receivers. These are guys you're not going to want to cover. I mean, wow. So I don't know if I want to be a safety in the NFC West. So, Talanoa Hufanga, you got your work cut out for you. So he's going to have some fun.
Another guy, though, that you kind of wish that he was there last year, get 1 year with Robert Saleh, who's now the Jets head coach, because I think he was, you know, a fantastic defense coordinator. I think it's D'Amico Ryans is going to be the defense coordinator now for the 49ers, his first time as a DC. So don't know what to expect. You know, if he's great, that helps out Talanoa even more.
Marlon Tuipulotu with the Eagles. Any thoughts there?
My in-laws are all Eagles fans, so, I now can root for one player on the team, I guess.
There you go.
Nice. Yeah, I was still afraid. Yeah, I mean, you know, we'll see. Like, whenever you're transitioning off of, like, who you think your franchise quarterback is going to be, there's going to be some transition going on. Certainly the Eagles have transitioned. I mean, you know, it just really fell off a cliff from winning the Super Bowl a couple years ago, as Shotgun's family, you know, can attest to. But, yeah, I mean, obviously passionate fans. We'll see. I mean, he made himself some money, I think, the first couple games of the season. Just really, Jay Toffoli opts out. He still is going to be okay. I don't know where Marlon, if he would have got selected that high, had he not, if he opted out and he didn't come back. I think he, especially with the linebackers not playing well for the first couple of games, it was up to him. He was basically running the show on the defense. So I think those first couple of games at least made him some money.
Mm-hmm. And since we saw him live and in person in Provo, I just want your thoughts. Zach Wilson to the Jets. Any thoughts there?
I mean, I didn't see him as a number two overall pick a year and a half ago, or what was that? Is that a year and a half ago? 2 years ago?
At this point? I don't know.
But, you know, good luck to him. The Jets have not had success with their early round picks, and it hasn't always been the early round picks' fault. So We'll see what Sam Darnold does with Carolina versus the Jets, and we'll see if Robert Saleh has more success than what they had previously under the varied head coaches they've had in the last decade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been a revolving door, obviously. There's been, I like Zach Wilson as a prospect, but it just seemed like it's been the hot thing. You want to get the young quarterback. You can win. If you can get your Patrick Mahomes, whatever, and you get him on the rookie deal, you can have like what, Russell Wilson was when he was on his rookie deal in Seattle. You get the star quarterback, but he's still on his rookie deal. You can get a lot of pieces around him. Then when you pay the guy, it's really hard to kind of keep the team going. So everyone wants to get that guy. And you see Josh Allen like, oh my God, like he was in Wyoming. He was completed 50% of his passes. Now he's a stud for the Bills, right? So can you find that guy? And there's definitely guys that it's working out for. And then some guys it's not. You get the Jared Goffs that go number one, and then you get traded off, and we'll see what he's able to do in Detroit. But yeah, that seems like a little bit of a reach, but it's just sort of been the hot thing, like there's trends, right? You're like, oh, we're not taking any running backs in the first round or whatever, and then it would come back a little bit. Then it just became like a quarterback thing. I think first 7 or 8 picks were all offensive players in the NFL draft. I don't think that's ever happened before, so yeah. Sort of these trend things are happening, and he was definitely part of it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing is that quarterback is such an important position. It's the number one position, and if you don't have a franchise quarterback, it's so difficult to make it to a Super Bowl. It's very rare just to make it to a Super Bowl without a franchise quarterback, much less win one. There's very few times that Trent Dilfer wins a Super Bowl. Things just all have to come together, and you have to have an amazing defense. Doesn't happen very often. That's what everyone's searching for. And if you feel like, you give somebody 3 or 4 years and you go, can't get us to a Super Bowl. All right, well, it's time to cycle them out and try somebody else. And you've seen so many guys that, have been busts, but it's just because they're being pushed up the draft boards because of the importance of quarterbacks. Like Jake Locker is not a top 10, top 15 pick in any draft unless the quarterback position is so valuable. If that position wasn't as so much more valued than any other position, he's probably a second round pick. That was the talent there. But guys like that get bumped up. All the guys that came before Patrick Mahomes get bumped up. Mahomes himself gets bumped up. No one expected him to be that type of quarterback off the top. He hadn't had that production necessarily at Texas Tech. There was potential, but it still hadn't been realized. So I think it's just the way the quarterback position is viewed now.
Mm-hmm. Any overall draft thoughts before we move on?
Alabama getting 6 first round draft picks is like, holy crap. Like that is amazing.
Wait, more telling, Ryan, that they got 6 first round draft picks or that their long snapper also got drafted.
Yeah. Only 8 overall, right? I think only 8 overall,
but down year for them.
Yeah. But 6 first rounders, their 2017 class was ridiculous. So if you remember like recruiting at a high level, that's recruiting at a high level. And just so everyone, everyone in the back, I want you to like listen up. Stars matter. They do matter.
I was about to say. Okay. Yep.
Yeah. Oh, this guy was picked 15th and he did. Yeah. Yes, that happens. But the majority of the dudes getting selected high are like top 5. They're high in their recruiting class. Like you have 32 guys that are 5 stars every year and thousands of other dudes. Some of those other dudes are going to get drafted because there's thousands of them. But a really high percentage of the guys that are those 5-star guys, there are only a few of them, do get drafted high. So, yes, stars matter.
Also, development matters because USC has had plenty of high-end guys that aren't ending up in the first round like those Alabama guys are. So development definitely matters. And also recruiting matters because one of the things that I noted was, oh, there's Penei Sewell that USC wanted to get. Oh, there's Jackson Carman that USC wanted to get. Oh, there's Wyatt Davis, who they kind of passed on. He ends up, I think, in the 3rd or 4th round. But those offensive linemen that we talked about in the past of, why is USC struggling on the offensive line? Well, this is the list of guys they've missed, their top targets year over year. And some of those guys were coming out in this draft and seeing them. Even though Austin Jackson and Elijah Vera Tucker back-to-back first rounders, and good for USC. I mean, they were promoting the heck out of that on all their Twitter feeds, all their social media, all the offensive coaches having those shirts. Do everything you can if you're USC to try to promote those offensive line because you need to get some offensive linemen in. Yeah. You still have not been getting those high-end guys recently. And with the number of guys that they have coming in for visits in the summer – coming up, and a lot of those are out-of-state guys, and there's some big-time offensive linemen in there. Yes, they're doing a great job of selling the back-to-back first-rounders, offensive linemen. But you see some of those other guys that are out there that they weren't able to close on, and you see Penei Sewell going in the top 10. You see Jackson Carmen, I think he was a top 50 pick, and you know, some of those guys, and you know, those are the guys that they, you know, were close on, but couldn't close the deal, and you see them being drafted, and you go, what could have been?
Yeah, Diamador Lenore, Thomas Graham.
Both guys they passed on.
Passed on, they both go to Oregon, they both get drafted. You're like,
Thomas Graham is... It still kind of upsets me because of how great their family is, and his sister was at USC.
He loved USC.
Yeah, and
they passed on him.
Ronnie Bradford came in. He was committed to USC, and basically,
I interviewed him.
Felt like, you know what? He's not the prototype of what we're looking for. You know, he's not the right size, length. He makes a lot of plays, yeah, but not the size and potential that we're looking for.
Yeah.
And instead, they basically kind of pushed him out of the class, and he goes to Oregon, has a great career, and congratulations to him on being an NFL draft pick. Him and Diamador Lenore, both great guys to talk to during the recruiting process.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was starting right away. Like, that was just a huge miss on USC. Keely, I got a question for you.
Okay.
So Chaka was talking about, I thought the USC social media team did a great job. You do the back-to-back first-round draft picks.
Yes.
Now, obviously, it's paling in comparison to six in the first round from Alabama and all
but
of that.
Yes, continue.
But it's good. I thought they did a good job.
Yes.
But does it sort of fall flat when day two goes by and nobody gets drafted? So it's sort of like crickets for the next whole day.
What's the alternative? Not celebrate your first-round draft pick because day two might not go well?
I think it's just sort of like you're kind of like beating your drum, which is good. I think you want to do that, but it just... Then when there's nothing to follow, you wanted some follow up there, right? And then there
but
was
they can't control that. You celebrate your first round pick, and
right.
then
you perfect. Celebrate all wins, you know, and you push them as much as you can. It's all about the hype, you know. Do you think BYU was going, well, we may not have anybody else drafted for a while?
Yeah,
it's BYU.
Do we not celebrate that Zach Wilson's number two overall and is one of the top guys ever to come out of BYU? No, you celebrate the heck out of that and sell that to every recruit you can. You know, you say, okay, come be Steve Young, come be Zach Wilson, come be Steve Sarkisian, you know.
Ty Detmer.
The BYU litany of quarterbacks.
Yeah. I think that's a loser mentality, Ryan.
All right, perfect. Hey, I'm with it. I just wanted to check. There was something that was like yeah, that seems a little weird.
And it's interesting because, you know, there are probably expectations. Well, we think Amon-Ra is going to go second day. You know, so the social media team was probably thinking that as well.
Right.
Yeah.
So they had some tweets ready.
It'll be a little bit different if it was like, we know we have this one dude, and then we're probably not going to have anybody until maybe day three. And, you know, maybe the social media strategy then changes. You know, that would have been kind of interesting to see, you know, if they put together a strategy and say, okay, what do we do on day two if we know we don't have anybody? We know we're not going to be in the news. What can we do to, you know, to hype up this first round draft pick and go? But I thought they did a good job of what, you know, all the shirts and everything. I thought it was really great.
Yeah.
Yeah. They had a site for every draft pick, and then they also had an alum. That who's in the NFL, congratulate whoever got drafted. I thought it was a good coordinated.
Yeah, like Juju and those guys.
And Leonard Williams. Yeah. All that. Yeah, so nice there. Ryan, you mentioned Alabama. We got a question for you from Greg, who says, how concerned are you with USC possibly being in third place for first round total draft picks with Alabama catching up?
I mean, I didn't sleep much last night because of that. No, I don't get concerned of those kind of things. But, like, yes, when you're talking about a team like Alabama being able to pick up six first rounders in a year, and it's, you know, if I don't know what their draft, but it's not like they're going to get shut out next year. They'll probably have at least a couple. They are definitely piling up numbers faster than USC is. And you had that, you know, that 2020 class is going to be going through there. Are they going to be first rounders in that? Probably not. Yeah, I think USC, you know, over the next 3, 4, 5 years is probably not going to be in first place in a lot of those categories because, you know, Alabama's up there, Ohio State's up there, Notre Dame is still up there. They're going to playoffs and stuff, and USC isn't. USC needs to have that kind of success. They still have the historical success, and they're still being able to put guys in the first round and you know, get a bunch of dudes drafted. They tied for the most. They had 5 guys drafted. I think Oregon and Stanford each did in the Pac-12. But you want to compete with the big boys getting like one first round draft pick and nobody in the second or third round. You keep having classes like that, you're going to be passed.
Shotgun, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is a little bit cyclical. You know, when Nick Saban leaves Alabama, are they going to find the next great coach? That'll be the question because, you know, in coming out of the 80s, Alabama was probably up there, you know, because USC had struggled in, you know, the late 80s, early 90s, you know, so maybe Alabama moved it, you know, up closer to them, whatever. But then when they struggle, you know, obviously USC. So over the long haul, it's a little bit cyclical in that regard, but it is definitely, it is notable. I don't know if it's concerning, those type things that don't really bother me one way or the other. Don't really look at those things, but for USC, you know, they got to sell this as much as they can right now to try to get that next group of recruits that will be, you know, a team because, you know, that's what you're looking for. It's all about selling to recruits and, you know, being able to hype any of those type statistics and numbers. You want to be able to do as much as you can. So right now, while they still hold on to the top of some of those rankings, and they should be selling them as much as they can.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm actually going to jump into a call that we have. It's our buddy Dave from Iowa. Hello, you are live on Tunnel Vision.
Hey, Tunnel Vision, good to talk again. I got a couple questions, one, just in terms of the draft, I mean, I don't know if you guys noticed, but more Northern Cal players got drafted than Southern Cal. Do you think USC should start hitting like Sacramento, the Bay Area, a bit more? I mean, Javon Holland, I mean, it kind of just says something right there, but you do you. But one thing I got to ask you guys, take it or leave it, USC goes 3-for-3 in terms of an offensive lineman in the first round next year. And if you take it, who's your guy?
Interesting.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks, Dave.
Yeah, Najee Harris, obviously, another NorCal guy. Mm-hmm. USC usually recruits, but, you know, right now it's sort of like Southern California and then Texas is like the secondary because you got all those coaches in Texas.
USC, when they're going good, they cherry pick from Northern California, but yeah, they don't really go in really heavily. Now, they were involved with Najee Harris.
Right.
They've got a couple players from up there. Elijah Vera Tucker, obviously. Yeah. He was high school teammates with Javon Holland. I saw Holland, I think he was a sophomore when I saw him. Maybe he was a year behind Elijah Vera Tucker when I went to watch Bishop O'Dowd. And this guy, I was like, this guy could be a player. And I was surprised USC never went a little bit harder on him. But, you know, when you have targets in your backyard, and that's the thing is a lot of times you're getting the same type of player as far as the physicality, it's not like, oh, they've got a bunch of big linemen like they do in the South versus Southern California. You know, it's similar type of players in that regard. Similar type of schemes are used across California. So it's not like it's a vastly different type of player. So I think you look in your backyard and you go, okay, well, we got a safety that we like here and this is who it is. And you go get him rather than going to NorCal for him. But when USC's going well, they can go up there and cherry pick and pick up some of the players that they want to get. You bring a kid from De La Salle or you bring a kid down from Bishop O'Dowd and add them to the mix rather than it being, you know, strength of their recruiting, you know, one of their hotbed areas of Northern California. But right now, yeah, like Ryan said, it's Texas. One of the concerning things, though, is there was a stat put out about how many players have been drafted from the home state of the players. And California was like fourth or fifth and was a heavy slide from the top three, which were Texas, Florida, and Georgia, I believe. That's usually, you know, those and California are usually the top four. And usually it's California and Texas by a pretty good margin because of their size, you know, just the size of the states. And Florida is usually up there. They just produce way more per capita than any other place. And then Georgia is usually up there as well. But California and Texas usually have a pretty good strength, and California was sliding down that. That's a little bit concerning to me. And part of it, I think, is when USC is not going well, more talent wants to leave, and it's tougher to become a really good player when you have to leave home and you leave that, you know, that shell that you have to fall back on, you know, when you're having a bad day, being able to go get mom's cooking or whatever it may be.
Yeah. For a second question, if you still remember it.
Take it or leave it.
I'm going to leave it. No first round draft pick.
Listener of the Family Feud pod. Mm-hmm. I'll
yeah.
Say.
No first round draft pick on the offensive line for USC.
I'm going to leave it as well.
There's no one you would even look at. The question is, will anyone from that offensive line group be drafted that's draft eligible next year?
Yeah.
Don't know.
We'll see about that, but certainly not a first rounder, at least that we've seen so far.
So I'm going to merge both topics tonight based on a question that I got yesterday from someone who knew that I covered USC football. They said, how does USC have back-to-back first rounders, offensive linemen, and yet have trouble running the ball? Take it away, guys. I want to see how my answer compared with you guys.
We've got a lot of people are tweeting about that stuff. USC, what have they been good at? Like, they're going to get recruits. Paul Hackett got Carson Palmer and Troy Polamalu. Like, you're going to get stud players. Having a bunch of stud players around the program doesn't mean you're going to be a great program. We've seen that from USC countless times. You have to have a great system in place, like Alabama does, so you get the great players and you're putting them in a great system. USC doesn't have that. They're trying to build that. They're, you know, the new administration, they're trying to put the pieces in place all around it. They've got better assistants and all that. So yeah, USC can have individual stars. They've always had that, but that does not translate to team success.
Sade?
Five fingers and a fist, you know, that analogy where offensive line is such a unit, you know, you have to be a unit to be good at something. And also the NFL focuses more on pass protection than run blocking. Just the way the game has transpired and transitioned to passing the ball more frequently, it's more about the pass blocking there. You still have to run block. I'm not saying that's not a case, but less important for them as they're looking at draft. Now, obviously, Elijah Vera Tucker is a mauler. Austin Jackson, you would say, definitely has potential in the run game coming out of USC, something he would still have to work on as he continued. But, you know, that's the difference there, I think. You know, you can have a 400-pound offensive lineman that just runs everybody over in college, but, you know, if he can't move in the NFL, then he's not going to be drafted in the first round either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Shaka tweeted out a picture of, you know, Austin Jackson and Elijah Vera Tucker next to each other. Shouldn't you be able to run the football? There's two first rounders like right next to each other, right? Yeah, that's a failure on USC's part.
But two guys can't block 11. That's also part.
Right. Yeah.
So it takes, you know, it takes the other guys on the offensive line. It takes that tight end. It takes the scheme to be able to open it up. You know that you're blocking two guys versus, you know, there being three or four guys there. You know, Austin Jackson and Elijah Vera Tucker were really good, but they can't block two guys each.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. All right, I'm going to move into spring camp, and then we'll get into questions. I know they're rolling in, so thank you guys for that. But like I said, 2021 spring camp is officially in the books. USC made it out, all 15 practices, no real COVID issues, which was nice to see. We got to see a majority of those practices. Since we already were talking about the run game, let's get into it. Clay McGuire, this was his first camp as a Trojan coach. What did you guys think of him as an offensive line coach?
I think it helped having Todd Orlando on the other side. I think it really was pushed. Everything was pushed by the defense. I think that it became a much more physical session of practices. And I think that helps Clay McGuire in the offensive line. He had a lot of bodies. There was a lot of depth there, even when you got some injuries. We've seen springs before. We had like eight guys out there. That wasn't the case this year. He needed to get film on all of these guys. He needed to see them practice, and I think he was able to accomplish that. We didn't see a lot of shifting around and trying different, you know, options by the end of the spring, the last couple of weeks, between the injuries and the option to try to like show guys in different spots. We saw a bunch of different positions being played. We saw Andrew Voorhees move out and play some left tackle and maybe make a name for himself there. We saw Milik, you know, come in and play center. We saw Monheim come out and, you know, look like he could potentially be the right tackle. So I like what they were able to do. It's going to be up to Clay McGuire now to kind of look at all that film and figure out what's going on. Clay Helton said, you know, they're going to practice. All the spots are open, but they have, what, 25 practices for fall camp. And it'll be interesting to see throughout the summer where they look like if we get to watch any of those workouts. And then going into camp, you know, is it the same setup we've seen? The same lineup we've seen through the first few practices, or are they going to move guys around? It's going to be up to Clay McGuire to kind of figure that out. But I think they got a pretty good test because the young defensive line played well. The defense in general played well. They pushed the envelope as far as physicality goes, and I think the offensive line benefited from that.
Mm-hmm. Shotgun, any thoughts on that? I know we saw a lot of shuffling and even more so because of injuries. Was there a specific line that you preferred seeing?
I mean, I liked Andrew Voorhees at left tackle. I thought it should be explored more. I think that's something that I'm still curious to see if that does happen. Just because now they've talked up Cortland Ford and Casey Collier and Jonah Monheim, but when the lights were on, Andrew Voorhees was the guy that that blocked the best out of him and playing the position that he hadn't been practicing at the rest of the time. So, and part of that is experience. You know, he knows what he's doing. He's played tackle before, but you know, I'd be curious to see it, you know, explored more. And I think probably the most interesting development as far as the players and depth chart is that Jonah Monheim is definitely pushing. Can he push his way into the first five? And if he does, do things get shifted around? Does he change positions? Does he move to the left side? Does he move inside? But because, you know, they've said we got to find the best five and then we'll find out where they play. Well, if he's one of the best five, is it now a shuffle? Does he go inside? Do you move Jalen McKenzie inside and he plays right tackle? There could be a number of things. So I think that's the most interesting development as far as the players go. As far back to Clay McGuire, I think the most interesting development there is that we saw different plays.
Yeah.
The offense running different plays. And that tells me that Clay McGuire is having an influence, because that was something I asked about, you know, leading into camp. You know, I asked him about going under center and he said, well, you know, we're going to sit down. Me and Graham are going to sit down and we'll talk about, you know, the offensive play calling basically. And he's going to give his input. And we saw some different plays and stuff. So I think that tells me that he is having some influence. And I think that tells you that Graham Harrell trusts him. And obviously, you know, he wouldn't have kind of signed off on this hire if he didn't trust him, a guy that he's worked under before, you know, a guy that was a coach on the staff when he was at Texas Tech. So, you know, I think he respects him. And, you know, if he comes in and says, hey, if we try this, I think it'll work. And then how well those plays worked against the defense, you know, when they saw something different, I think that would give Graham Harrell some confidence. So maybe we start seeing some different looks from USC and not just the base offense and only having, you know, the three-page binder or whatever it is that Graham Harrell's playbook has been championed as. Maybe we add a couple more pages to the playbook.
Mm-hmm. We definitely saw some new wrinkles. But, Ryan, you touched on this in your answer. This was technically the first real spring that USC's new defensive staff was able to have. They had one day last year, but they actually got a full camp this time. And
doesn't count, Keeley, if they weren't in full pads.
True. That's true, going off of their philosophy. So, really, their first spring camp. And they talked prior to the 2020 mishaps of COVID and whatnot about how they wanted to instill their culture, their physicality, and it seemed like this was finally the chance that they got to do that. It seemed like a more physical practice. We heard that from players who've been here, been at USC for a while. Ryan, what were your takeaways from what this defensive staff was able to do, just tone-wise and maybe culture-wise?
Yeah, I mean, they talk the talk, but then they walk the walk. We've heard a lot of talk, right, over the years. There's always like this iron sharpens iron, that you got the practice is going to be tougher than games. We've heard a lot of these things and never saw them practice that way or never saw the games turn out this way. And you have to give Todd Orlando credit, because he came out and was very matter-of-factual about, like, here's what we're going to do. This is why this doesn't matter. I don't care about practicing with no pads. We didn't get to put our culture in place. We didn't get to, like, show these guys what physical practices are like, because when we started in the fall, it was shortened and we had to get ready for games. So we're going to do that this spring. And then when we got to watch practices, it looks like that's what they did. So I have to give Todd Orlando a lot of credit. He was a no-nonsense kind of guy. He told you what was going to happen. It happened. We saw, I know some of the fans don't want to hear it, we saw spring that looked different than other springs. We saw more tackling than we've seen before. They were definitely pushing the envelope as far as like how many full pads practices you could have. So I think, you know, you got to give Todd Orlando a lot of credit. And we saw the defense flying around and making a lot of plays. And I think when you do that, you have one side of the ball that's kind of stepping up their game. It's forcing the other side of the ball to step up as well. So I like that he was sort of leading the way. And, you know, when you have one side of the ball being that physical, the other side of the ball has to respond. And I think the offense did too.
Mm-hmm. Shotgun, I know you have been critical about physicality throughout the Helton era. What were your thoughts from this camp?
I mean, it's the best camp that they've had. I like the practice plans. I like the amount of physicality as far as the tackling and going at it, but I really like the fact that they switched things up. Keeley and I have harped on this ad nauseum about when things aren't going the way you want them to go, well, you got to make some changes. You got to switch some things up. And that means the practice plans too. You can't do the same practice over and over and over and expect suddenly things are going to get that much better just because, hey, we hired a new coach and he's teaching something a little bit different, but we have the same practices. No, you need to, you know, make some adjustments, change some drills, do whatever it has to be. And we actually saw some adjustments this year as far as the practice plans. So I thought I was really, really positive development there, that they were making those changes. And I think you saw the outcomes from that, the effect of it, of switching, having the Trojan drill start out a couple practices, you know, switching and doing the goal line drill before you go into your short yardage, you know, situations and your full set of plays you're going to do. It was what, four plays, three plays that they did on the goal line, but it completely changed that entire practice.
Yeah.
The fact that you go from a ho-hum practice to everyone's excited, everyone's pumped up, and that's the type of things you have to do. And maybe even do it, sometimes you have to realize this practice isn't going, you know, just doesn't have the energy, doesn't have the juice that we want. We need to make an adjustment and do it on the fly and throw in an extra drill and call everybody up and just be like, hey, we're not doing what we need to. We're going to go to this right now. And just so those are the type of things that they need to have been doing and they haven't, and just kind of expected things to get better. Well, now they've made some adjustments. So, you know, it's a continuation of what we've seen for the last year and a half, where slowly, step by step, they're making adjustments in the right direction. You know, how long does it take to get to where they need to be? That's a different question. But they're slowly moving in the right direction with everything from recruiting to what they're doing on the practice field now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Shotgun's exactly right with that point. If you're going to do the same thing day after day after day, you can start mailing things in. And I feel like that was happening a lot of times. You need to be able to get a spark somehow. And, you know, it started with those Trojan drills in the beginning of practice. And it did set the tone. They're like, okay, this is different. And we even talked about before when time after time you're having practices with no pads. When you open your locker and the shoulder pads are there and your thigh pads are there, and like, okay, this is a different, like your mentality changes. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that was definitely lacking. And this was, and you know, if you listen to the Peristyle podcast, Coach Harvey Hyde talks, you know, when he was the head coach at UNLV, just sometimes you have to read the room and you're like, mm-hmm. something's not going right. I think one time he said, like, he didn't like some of the assistant coaches, what they were doing. He sent all his assistant coaches off the field. Like, I'm coaching the whole field now. And so, like, you think you're going to get the player's attention if you do something like that? Like, your assistant coach is now thrown off the field? Like, yeah, it's not going to be mundane. It's not going to be same old, if your head coach is coming in and, like, taking over the whole practice. Sometimes you need something like that. We just haven't seen much of it. A little bit more of it, I think, this spring.
I also think it helped that they didn't have a spring last year. We heard from both coaches and players. They were just so fired up just to be back on the field and be able to practice. So I think that definitely helped, because I know Todd Orlando, or no, it was Craig Nivar, who said, you know, around practice 9-10, there's supposed to be a lull, but they were still fired up at that point. So definitely an added benefit, if you will. We're reaching the top of the hour, so I'm going to ask one more question before I dive into viewer questions. Coming out of camp, from what you saw, I want one, I guess, positive and one concern you have. Not concern, but you know what I mean, in a neutral journalistic way.
I guess I'll start. Sure. I'm definitely more optimistic about the defensive side of the ball than I was before. We saw them get better, I think, through the shortened 2020 season. I have a lot of confidence that, as a whole, that the defense is going to improve. We've got to see some, you know, I trust Todd Orlando and what he's going to end up doing with the linebacker group. But I love the way the defensive line played. I think Vic Soto is just a gem of an assistant coach. So I have more confidence there on the defensive side of the ball. Certainly, I mean, the common one going into spring, coming out of spring, is still going to be on the offensive line. I felt before like you could have like an okay offensive line and the offense was still going to be really good and elite. I think, you know, Keaton Slovis looked better than what we saw, you know, during the season in 2020. But I think you're going to need a higher level of offensive line play than maybe I felt you did before. Just get the run game going. You know, run the ball on the third and ones and any kind of short yardage stuff when you know the other team knows you're going to run. And even just to keep the passing game flowing, there's still going to be, you know, Keaton Slovis to Drake London making these huge plays. But can you have those sustained drives and can you have like a consistent offensive output as opposed to the kind of roller coaster that we've seen before? I think you're going to need a higher level offensive line play to avoid some of that roller coaster where you just go a couple of drives with nothing's going on and then you hit the big play and score a touchdown.
Mm-hmm. Shotgun, your thoughts?
Ryan, you said that you thought that they could still have an elite offense with an okay offensive line. I think that's the case. The problem is they haven't been okay. You know, you have to, because there's two facets of, you know, an offensive line. It's pass protection, which you've had multiple quarterbacks get hurt. So I don't know if you would say that's, you know, anywhere, you know, even okay. It's okay. That's concerning for sure. The run game has definitely not been okay. So if they can get to okay in the run game, don't have to be maulers, don't have to lead the nation in rushing. But if you can get to okay, then yeah, I think this can still be an elite offense. I think that's still a possibility under Graham Harrell, mixing in some different plays and doing some different things to help that run game. I think that would definitely help too. You know, the fact that it seemed like teams knew exactly what was going to happen every time you ran to the line and tried a quick snap on third and one or fourth and one, and you got, you know, there was somebody in the backfield every time, then yeah, mix it up. Change it up. Where's the play action? Where's the toss to the tight end? Where's the counter off that? Those type of things you need to throw in there to keep defenses honest, basically. So I think the offensive line is still a concern. My positive is the defensive line, even though that it should be a concern at defensive tackle right now. It should be actually some major concerns because Tufele is gone. Tuipulotu is gone. Now Tremblay transfers out. You have Brandon Peely goes down with an injury. So you have no experience basically there. Mm-hmm. But we've seen a lot of positive signs from Jay Toya. We've seen positive signs from Jamar Sakona that those guys are going to take a step forward. Now, are they ready to be a Marlon Tuipulotu or a Jay Tufele? I don't think so. But is Ishmael Softshire, is he a guy that can step in and be your starter? Is Jacob Lichtenstein a guy that you can bump down? And then, you know, you don't need anyone to be a star there. You don't need anyone to be the stud that Marlon Tuipulotu was early in the season. But can you get some consistent contributions from three or four guys? Then I think you have something there, and I think that's what you're going to see. So instead of being a concern, I think that group's going to be okay. So I think that's a positive for USC. A lot of playmakers on that defense, especially in the secondary. I think that those young guys, as they continue to progress, are going to be really good. My concern is actually Keaton Slovis. You know, there's a lot of interceptions this spring. He's got to be better. You know, that, and maybe it's you're working with new wide receivers, kind of getting a feel. There's a lot of things going on. But it's year three. This is draft year. You know, you can't be throwing 10, 15. You know, there's 15 practices. We saw, what, 8? And we saw at least 10 interceptions. So, you know, if it's just got to be better. It has to be better. You know, is he back to 2019 form or is it 2020 form? That's the question everybody wants to know about his arm strength. And it's okay. It's fine. It's not great. I don't think it's back to 2019 form. And I think part of that is confidence and being able to drill that ball in there. And when you have double-digit interceptions in a spring camp, I think that, you know, that starts hurting that a little bit. So Keaton Slovis is a little bit of concern for me. I think that they got to get him right and get him on track. And they do. He goes back to 2019 form where he's whipping the ball around the yard and having fun. And you go, that's when this offense, and that's when, to Ryan's point, it can become elite with an okay offensive line on the run game.
Mm-hmm. I agree with all you guys. I'm going to say different things just to be different. I think the positive, I was impressed with how different guys on the defense stepped up in leadership ways and just seemed like they had a better sense of the defense both on the field and off the field. Isaiah Polamau, really go forth. Kanai Mauga, he's a guy who definitely stepped up. And Chase Williams has been really vocal. I know that's something I've talked about all spring camp, but it's true. And then as far as a concern, I'm going to go outside the box and actually say who's going to be USC's third wide receiver? Like, who's going to be the third target? Because, you know, you obviously Drake London, that's going to be your main target there. I think Brew McCoy, if he's healthy, that's going to be a guy you're definitely going to go to. But then Gary Bryant, is he going to be healthy? What's that going to look like? Is Katie Nixon going to be more consistent? I don't know. I just feel like there's a lot of pressure on Drake London's shoulders right now.
Yes.
And I don't know who's going to be those other guys to step up necessarily right now. So we'll see. That's something in fall camp you kind of want to keep your eye on to see if that develops more. So those are my concerns.
Yeah, I wanted to see more from Katie Nixon. I thought he could be, but, you know, maybe he'll be a gamer, but we just haven't seen the consistency from him. And, you know, maybe it's a Kyle Ford. Michael Jackson looked really good.
Yeah,
you know,
true.
You can see John Jackson. You know, there's some options, but you're right. Usually there's like these established positions. And the whole point that Kerry Colbert was talking about, that they might move guys around more because you don't have like, oh, we have Tyler Vaughns here. We have Amon-Ra St. Brown here. We have Michael Pittman here. Like, you don't have that stuff anymore. You basically have Drake London, and he can go wherever, and you're going to move him outside, and everybody else. And, you know, which guys is it going to be? We don't know.
Yeah, but we'll see. Usually for USC, their wide receiver group steps up pretty impressively. So I don't think it will be a huge concern, but just something I have my eye on. But let's jump into questions. I believe we have one from NJ2K who says, a quick question. How did USC go out and hire all these recruiters and we don't have a top 10 class already? A little nervous because this class is giving me 2020 flashbacks. Thanks.
It's May 2nd.
You can still be in the top 10 on May 2nd, right?
Yeah, you can. I mean, but I wouldn't be concerned about where you're ranked in recruiting on May 2nd as much.
Yeah.
as I would like February 2nd.
Definitely then. yeah. I think that there's not a concern there for me because you look at the list of players that are coming in for the visits. It's not like they've already been rebuffed by some because we're seeing a lot of top 10, top 8, top 5 lists. And it's not like a ton of USC's, you know, guys that you're like, oh, that's a guy that USC, you know, probably should get or should be in contention for. And you go, wait, that guy's not there anymore? There's a couple of them out there, like A.J. Duffy, you know, the fact that he cut USC out pretty early. You kind of wonder about that one in the quarterback. But for the most part, there's a lot of players, especially on the defensive side, and that's the work of that group. Dante Williams and Craig Nyvar together, you know, going out and you know, really recruiting their tails off. So I'm not really concerned there. The pieces they already have, I think, are solid pieces. The fact that you're already – Damani Jackson is committed, you know, is going to help, you know, be able to sell the class as well going forward. So I'm not that concerned. And the fact that they are – the investments they've made into recruiting, just the different graphics, the different videos, all that type of stuff that they've done tells you that they understand how important recruiting is when not necessarily last year or the 2020 class, but – you know, for about a 5-year stretch, it's like USC kind of felt like we can rest on our laurels and people will come to USC just because. You know, that was kind of always the saying in recruiting circles is like USC is going to get, you know, its amount of players just because it's USC. And I think USC kind of, the staff kind of rested on that. And instead, you know, when they didn't get some of those, you go, oh, wow, what happened? Now it feels like they have those young guys that are, you know, voracious recruiters, you know, bringing in Jeff Martin, bringing in
Brian Carrington.
Marshall Sherrington.
Yeah. I knew there was a C and I knew there was double letters in the middle, but popping into my head. But yeah, the investments they made there, I think that and the graphics, the video, all that type stuff, they understand how important it is to not only just continue doing what you're doing, but try to get out and be, you know, top of the line, you know, be on the cutting edge of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ryan, what was the Dante quote from last March when he said you can't just rely on this and pointing to the USC logo?
I think this made your floor higher. Now, we saw 2020, the floor was a lot lower than we thought it could be because that was the worst class we've ever seen. But your floor is just going to be higher. But you still have to achieve a top 5 class. And we saw, at least in 2021, there was more achievement going on. But, yeah, there's still some work to do in 2022. I wouldn't be too concerned in early May.
Yeah, you win games, you get more recruits.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That helps raise the floor and the ceiling.
If you work really hard at recruiting and you do all the right things, you have a 500 season, you're still going to get a good amount of recruits, local recruits, people that grew up going, I love USC, that's the school, my dream school. They're really selling me on it. I see how I can fit there. Still going to come. But that 5-star kid from Texas or from Florida or across the country, not coming if you're 500. Now, if you are in college football playoff contention, yes, that's the type of kids that are coming. That's, you know, the 5-star kids that are really competitive, the ones you really want, they're looking for a place where I can go, I can be on the biggest stage, which is trying to play for a national championship. And that's why a team like Alabama, who's so consistently been in the playoffs, been in contention for a national title, they can pull players from all over the country. Not because of everything they say in their recruiting pitch is, you know, the most brilliant thing ever. It's what they've done and, you know, the legacy they've created in the last decade.
Mm-hmm. It's almost 8, so let's go into rapid fire mode. We got a question on Facebook that said, outside of Slovis, which current player can be an early round draft pick next year?
Drake and Drake.
The question, I'm really curious what NFL scouts think about Drake London. Now, if he goes outside and dominates, then yeah, I think so. But I wonder if there will be concerns. Where exactly does he fit? Is he a tweener? Is he fast enough? Is he big enough? All those type things. I think if you want to use him in a certain way, he can be a great mismatch. But that isn't always the case. You have to get creative offensive coordinators and people that want to feature mismatches instead of, you know, Graham Harrell's offense is more everyone run your route and someone will be open rather than let's move this guy over here and move this and moving the chess pieces more to create that mismatch. They just figure that there's going to be an open space based on the concept.
Mm-hmm. We got a question on, sorry, Ryan, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
No. Yeah. I mean, I think those two guys have the best chance. I mean, I don't know, maybe like an Isaiah Polamau or something, but I think, you know, there's a short list I would think after Slovis, but both first names would begin with Drake.
Oh, we got a question on YouTube from Hip Hop Lover who said, will Drake Jackson be the fourth team captain next year outside of Slovis, London, and Isaiah pull him out?
Good question.
I don't think so. I think it'll be maybe like Kanai Mauga, Jordan Iosefa, if healthy. I think he can be back being a captain. So I think there's some older options that probably on the defensive side. If it's three that you mentioned, it would be another defensive player. I don't think there's an overwhelming leadership quartet on the offensive side that you need quartet to put all as captains or anything.
Sure. What about Brett Nealon? Any thoughts on that?
I mean, potential. Anytime your center is always an option because they're the ones that talk all the time.
Sure.
And that's what you're looking for in a leader.
Mm-hmm. We had a question from AKA Boone who said, now that spring football is over, do you guys / gals, I feel like guys is an exclusive, inclusive word, I don't care, feel more same or less confident in USC next season, especially the offensive line?
Offensive line kind of still in the middle, not really stock up or stock down, pretty much the same.
Stock neutral?
No.
Stock
much
neutral.
The same.
I'll
stock
go with that.
Neutral, thank you.
Means the stock did not change. I feel, still things to work on. I don't feel like anyone just impressed so much that you're like, wow, that guy's really locked in as a starter. Overall, I feel more confident because of the coaching staff and seeing the impact of the defensive staff, preaching physicality and the fact that they actually went about doing it the right way, doing it on the practice field rather than, saying that they want to be physical. They went out and actually were physical in practice, and that will eventually translate if they continue it.
Mm-hmm. We got one from Doug on Periscope.
Hey, Periscope.
Hey, Periscope. Or not Periscope, sorry, YouTube Live.
Okay.
I think, it still says like,
You mean Twitter Live?
I'm sorry. Oh, my God. Yes. Twitter Live. Holy cow. Sorry. There's so many platforms. But
so many platforms.
Periscope's apparently dead, but we're still kind of using it. Doug, do you see the tight end playing a more prominent role in the offense this year? How about two running back sets?
We've seen the latter in practice. I don't know if we're allowed to say that. So
we've seen it.
They talked about it.
Yeah, okay.
So, we've seen more two tight end sets. We've seen more two running back sets. Will that translate into the fall? I'm not sold on that yet. I think that is much more a product of the fact that you had what was the last practice that I was at? There was three scholarship wide receivers or two scholarship wide receivers?
Tuesday for you, sir.
So they were healthy and able to participate at the end. So you're not going to throw a bunch of walk-ons out there when you have scholarship tight ends and scholarship running backs that you can put on the field and see what they can do instead. Maybe you see a little bit more. The tight end position still needs development, still needs to be more active and more productive in the run blocking. And if it is, then they stay on the field all the time, and then they can start catching some passes. Late McCree showed some nice things. Michael Trigg, when he comes in, he could be a mismatch problem as well.
Mm-hmm. In the same vein, you kind of already touched on it, but Jesse wanted to know how the tight ends do overall this spring. He says USC needs their production.
Yeah, it's about the same. Meh.
See, but does that change at all with Trigg coming in? Do you anticipate that?
I don't know if it's about personnel. It's just about how are they going to be used. I'm not
but
worried about the
time. He's the type of guy where you could use him differently.
It's personnel because the way you're using them is perfectly fine if they block well. But if they don't block well, then you get running plays that are blown up and stuff. And Eric Cronin has come a long way from where he was a freshman. And the fact that he was starting playing as a freshman was kind of concerning because that's why Kerry Angeline left, part of the reason. And he goes and, has a successful career with NC State. They have to be more productive in what they're being asked to do. And then they'll get more opportunities to go catch the ball and do different things. So Michael Trigg, can he come in? Is he going to be a stand-up, outstanding blocker to begin with? I don't think so. He was a wide receiver in high school a ton. I think it takes a little bit of time to develop as a blocker, as a tight end, unless someone's going from an offensive lineman and moving out to tight end, because you're just not used to that. And the kids you're blocking in high school are usually pretty small.
Yeah. We had a question on YouTube that said, could Jackson Dart lead SC to a championship? This was a Ryan Abraham loaded question because this seems a little spicy for my taste.
I mean, I just saw it up there. We get the backup quarterback love, and we don't know who's going to be the backup quarterback. We've seen Miller, the last practice we saw, Miller Moss, I thought, played better than Jackson Dart, you know, and that was the basically the backups. Did you feel that way, Keely, or?
What?
The last practice. Like, there was a lot of team stuff, but it was mostly the, all the full team periods were Miller Moss and Jackson
Dart. It was
Dart.
Young guys across the board getting final rest.
But,
for
like,
summer.
Moss, I thought, played better that, you know, but people just fall in love with a guy, and I think they've fallen in love with Jackson Dart.
I'm not going to make a championship prediction off of 15 practices of true freshman quarterbacks. Like, that's just not what I'm going to do.
But the key word there is could, and the answer is yes. The answer is always yes when could. But that would have nothing, doesn't even necessarily have to do with Jackson Dart. Look at the quarterbacks that cycled through Alabama that helped lead them to national championships. So is Jackson Dart better than some of those guys? Probably. You know, does that mean he'll lead him to a national championship? No, because it's going to take the offensive line playing well.
Yeah. I will say, though, he has a je ne sais quoi. He has that that bravado a little bit. You can see it. The confidence is kind of building there. We got a question on YouTube from Matthew, who says, what are your thoughts on Taj Washington? It's a question for you, Shotgun. He says, I think he will be a future draft pick.
I haven't seen, I haven't watched a lot of highlights of Taj Washington, a guy I would prefer seeing in person. Katie Nixon is a guy that I was really high on from my viewing in person of him, facing USC, and he hadn't lived up to the expectations yet. Now, changing offenses, getting used to new school, all that type of things could play into it. But, he hasn't lived up to where I was expecting. I thought he would come in and be able to take over that third wide receiver role. Instead, we're still worrying, kind of concerned about that and wondering what's going to happen there. Whereas I thought as a fifth-year guy with experience, he'd be able to come in and basically say, this is my spot. You guys fight for number four or fight for a different spot. I'm taking this one. But that hasn't happened yet. So Taj Washington, want to see him in person and see what he's got. But heard a lot of positive things about him so far.
Mm-hmm. We got a question from Coley, who says, would USC's coaches look at opponent spring games at all?
Coley has asked about this a couple times. Like, are USC's coaches going to watch the Notre Dame spring game? That's what he really wants to know. Yes, of course they are. Why do you think that coaches go so vanilla in spring games? Because someone is going to watch it on your schedule. Mm-hmm. So that's why you don't unveil any of the stuff that are going to be key components to your offense or any special play that you're going to draw up. Yeah, so they all watch those things. Now, how much stock do they put in it? They're not going to look at it and go, oh, look at that formation, look at what they're doing there. They're going to look at it and say, man, look at how quick Kyle Hamilton gets from sideline to sideline. What can we do to avoid him? Those are the type of things you look at in a spring game. You see, okay, that guy's making some plays. Who is it? Let's check the roster, see what that number is, and say, let's keep a note on him and see where he's at during the season if we need to keep an eye on him for something else.
Mm-hmm. Chaunchers on YouTube said, why are SC players in such a huge rush to leave early? There's no way these guys didn't get a draft analysis before deciding to leave. For most of these guys, staying another year would have made them more money.
Why do guys go to USC? Like, what's the big draw to be recruited to USC? Like, why is that ceiling high? You want to get that. There's a lot of dudes in the NFL that got the most draft picks ever. You're not coming to USC thinking, I'm going to go here for 5 years and get a master's degree and then maybe like make it in the NFL. These guys want to go to the NFL. You're going to look at any opportunity you have to get there. So if someone's saying, hey, you're going to be a second or third round pick, there's no reason for me to come back. Maybe 10 people are telling you won't be, but the one person that does, that's the one you're listening to because that's what you want to hear. So I think that happens a lot of times. It's not that USC players are in a rush, but you go to USC, you go to Alabama, you go to Ohio State, a big draw is you're going to get to the NFL. So you're going to get there as fast as you possibly can if you feel like you can do that instead of staying one extra year. A lot of times it happens. We've seen Alabama guys come back. We saw it happen this year in the draft. Najee Harris, Alex Leatherwood, a bunch of those guys did come back. And we've seen USC guys come back too, but you can't fault the guys that want to go early. That's the whole point. When they got to USC, they wanted to leave early.
Shotgun?
You go to be developed and get out of there. Does that always happen? No. But all these guys, when they come, if you're a 4 or 5-star guy, your goal is to get to the NFL. Yeah, some of them could make more money coming back. Elijah Griffin is probably the only one that I look at and say he needed to come back. An extra year of development would have done wonders for him, and then a team would have invested more in him as a draft pick than they will as an undrafted free agent. I think, again, that he has the potential that he can make a roster and stick around in the NFL, have a multi-year career. But the difference between an undrafted free agent is you can get cut real quick versus the guy they've already paid some money to with a little bit of a signing bonus. That guy, they're going to, we'll give him an extra chance. This guy, get him out of here. you know, if you're on even footing, we've already paid some money and invested some time into this guy. Let's keep him around a little bit longer and give him another opportunity. So I think that's the difference for him. But everybody else, was Marlon Tuipulotu going to go higher next year? Maybe, but another year in the trenches with a guy who's had a back injury? Go and try to make money now. Amon-Ra St. Brown, you see the hits he's taken during his career at USC, and he plays in the slot, and you know he's going to take some more hits. Go and make money now. There's not a giant jump between second round and third round or second round and fourth round. The big jump is from second round to first round, guaranteed money, guaranteed contract, and then actually from, you know, moving up, if you get into that top 15, the money becomes a little bit even bigger then.
Yeah, and it was a weird year because of the COVID stuff too. So that's a X factor in all of this.
Mm-hmm. We got a question from Mike on Facebook who said, will Corey Foreman just be a backup for Drake Jackson, or do you think they will find a way to get both of them on the field at the same time?
Yeah, I think you're going to see them both. I think you got to get those pass rushers on the field.
I mean, the question will be how much do they rotate? Does Drake Jackson become a guy that you never take off the field? Which we've seen some with pass rushers at USC. Uchenna Nwosu never came off the field. Porter Gustin, when he was healthy, never came off the field. Now, if you're rotating them and say, let's keep him a little bit fresher, let's rotate him in there, and we're going to have one guy that's an elite pass rusher at all times on the field, then I think that you're going to see them, you'll see them play the same position. Now, in certain pass rush situations, third and long situations, yeah, they're both going to be on the field. But as far as moving Corey to a different position when they've recruited him at that spot for Drake Jackson, to have them on the field at the same time, you know, as the primary defense, I think that comes down to how much you're going to rotate Drake Jackson. Because I think you're going to want to get Corey Foreman on the field, but if you want to keep Drake Jackson fresh, then you rotate more and you can leave him at that same spot.
We got a question on YouTube from David who says, who is going to anchor the offensive line in the fall?
I think it's a good question.
Well, I mean, Chuckin and I have both said it. Brett Nealon is kind of the only guy you can point to and being like, he's going to be on the field come 2021.
Yeah, he's the starter. You know what position he's going to be. Everyone else's position could be moved. And this goes back to 2 years now. 2 years ago, Austin Jackson leaves, and you go, we don't know where anyone else is going to be because everyone else moved. Brett Nealon was the only guy that has consistently been in one spot. So, and there's questions about that. Even though the offensive line for the majority of the spring was consistent what it was last year with the left tackle being the only difference. So I think you feel Brett Nealon's the anchor. We'll see what we do with the other four pieces.
Yeah. Jasper Smith says, going into fall camp, who should we expect to participate in fall that didn't participate in the spring?
I mean, you're going to see like a lot of the young DBs, like the Sierra Wrights of the world, right? They could have used some of those guys.
Fall enrollees, yeah.
But I mean, Corey Foreman is like the big one. Like, you want to see Corey Foreman come play.
Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to get a couple guys back from injury. Elijah Winston's a guy that, you know.
Bless you.
Thank you.
That I'm interested to see where they try to put him at. You know, obviously the inside linebackers are pretty thin. Is he back an inside linebacker? Is he back outside? They moved him around at different points in his career. Are the other two inside linebackers back? Solomon Tuliala-Pupu and Jordan Iosefa. Mm-hmm. Multiple knee injuries. I mean, multiple, let's say, lower body injuries for both those guys.
Yeah.
So, you know, if they're back and they practice a full week, then we'll discuss them, you know, about being potential starters, and then what do you do with the other guys? So those will be guys to watch to see if they practice and how much they practice.
I would say 81, Kyle Ford. I need a new guy.
He did participate in fall. Is Kyle Ford your new guy? Is like
he's my,
Tyler Vaughns has moved on and now.
Vaughns is gone. Now
is there
it's
a
Kyle
ceremony?
Ford.
Like, how does this happen?
He's going to get a plaque.
Okay. Okay, the official Ryan Abraham guy.
You're my dude now.
Yeah, the dude. Also, Nick Figueroa. We didn't really see Drake Jackson a lot. Ishmael Schoster, guys like that. I mean, I asked Clay Helton, do you expect any of the injuries suffered in spring to bleed into fall camp? And he basically said only the season-ending injuries are going to impact that. Brandon Peely with the Achilles, Mo Hassan with the ACL, and then Max Williams with the ACL as well. So USC, for the most part, should be healthy in June when they start their workouts. So there you go for that. We got a question from Coley White. Surprise, surprise. It involves South Bend. He says, by September 18th, the third game, will you be able to tell if USC is a playoff team, or does one have to wait until after the game in South Bend?
So what's the South Bend game?
It's the sixth game, yeah.
I think you...
It might be the seventh.
Middle of the season,
though. Sure, yes.
I think you'll have a much better idea, obviously, by Notre Dame. Will you know by the third game? I would normally say yes, because there's not a lot. It's not like you have a young quarterback. You're going to see if they develop. The big question is, though, is the offensive line. It's always the offensive line. It's been that way for about half a decade now. If the offensive line produces, will we know by three games the impact that Clay McGuire has? That's where I'm not sure. I don't know. What do you guys think? Do you think you will feel like, okay, yeah, they can run the ball, or is this the same thing?
So, okay, San Jose State, Stanford, and Wazoo. Those are the first three games.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to know.
And then you have Oregon State after that, and then at Colorado. Then you get Utah at home. I think the Notre Dame just tells you. The Notre Dame game, especially in South Bend, that's been a place where USC can come in prior to that, look good, and then South Bend just happens.
Yeah,
and then
sort it's of a kind slap of, in the
face. Yeah, it takes the wind out of the sails a little bit. Yeah.
I think you could know if the run game isn't working. I don't know if you would know that it is working against a quality line. Now, you know, Utah's going to be good for sure. Like, that's going to be – if you can run the ball against Utah, I think you'd have a decent shot of running against Notre Dame. But if you're running against Washington State, I'm not sure that you're going to, like, say, oh, yeah, we got a great run game now. And, no, that probably isn't going to be the case. But if you can't run the ball against Washington State – You're not going to be running against Utah. You won't be running it against Notre Dame, in my opinion.
Sure.
I mean, they didn't run the ball against Washington State this year because Washington State played man. So
one yard, correct?
Which year?
5 yards.
It was something. Yeah, there was like 5 yards. It was single digits. Yeah.
It's not great, but yes. We got a question on YouTube who says, do you foresee Graham Harrell expanding route concepts and evolving the offensive scheme? It's a Facebook question, my bad.
I think the offense is the offense. I don't think it's going to change all that much. People keep asking, like, are they going to put the I formation? Like, no, I don't think there's going to be a lot of changes going on. He kind of does what he does. You're going to tweak some little things and stuff, but I don't think you're going to have massive changes.
There's just some, I mean, it's not overhauling concepts. It's just throwing some counters in there to the plays, the things that you're already doing on a regular basis. And that's not really overhauling concepts, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. A couple more questions before we wrap this one up. A Trek Ranger said, when will team start double teaming Drake London?
August 6th is the first day of fall camp. So they'll start working on it then. Yeah, right away. Like, you're going to make someone else try to beat you. He is the dude. Like, you just watch him. You're going to watch this. Whatever you watch, you're going to be like, okay, he's really good. We're going to make sure, or try to make sure, he's not going to be the dude to beat us. I think the pick that Keen Slovis threw in the spring game, who was it?
London.
Yeah, so it was to London.
But he had.
Yeah, he had coverage over the top, and he had coverage underneath. You know, but Slovis threw it to him anyway. I think that's smart to do that. Make Slovis find somebody else open, and make London work twice as hard to try to beat two guys instead of one.
The answer is immediately, just like Ryan said. When will they stop double covering is when someone else proves that you can't do that. So if Brew McCoy goes and has 150 yards against San Jose State,
yeah,
Stanford's going to think twice about, all right, do we put that safety over the top and leave the middle of the field open if Taj Washington comes in and has 100 yards over the middle? You know, those type of things, that's what it takes. It takes a team effort for a receiver to be really good. You know, even guys like Michael Pittman are big, strong. You need that secondary guy to keep a little coverage off of them for them to go off.
Mm-hmm. Jarrett on YouTube says, who has the most unique / outgoing character / personality you guys have observed on the team?
Current team.
Katie Nixon is effervescent, I would say. Everyone loves him when they're around him. He brings a ton of energy. And that's the thing that was talked about initially when he was brought in. I think he brings that to the wide receiver room as well. The other guy is that people gravitate towards, I think, is Drake Jackson.
You know?
If you can do backflips, people are like, oh, I got to see this. But also, he just has a great personality, and everyone really enjoys being around him.
He is great. I was the first guy I was going to mention, like, we did a video when I did a video with him, I think his dad, and Corey Foreman. We did, like, all like a Zoom with all those guys together and stuff. And just, you know, lots of personality. It's been hard this last year because you don't. There's Zoom personality, and there's like, you're, you know, if Zach Banner walks by to Keeley and go, hey, you dropped your pocket. Like, there's like, you can't do that with Zoom, you know, quick interactions that make part of that why you would like a guy. And we don't get to do that with these guys right now.
I will say, though, Kanai Mauga has a personality that cracks me up. Shotguns knows this.
Keeley's like, that's my spirit animal there. That's my spirit.
Just because he's such a nuisance and in such a great, like, little brother type of way that I relate a little bit. So I would say Kanai Mauga for that.
I have to tell her, I'm like, he's not an animal except, you know, when he's making 16 tackles or 14 tackles against Utah.
Yeah.
True. But I just like the feistiness. Big fan of the feistiness. Shotgun, any questions that I missed that you feel like are worth asking before we wrap this one up?
I didn't have any saved in particular. This was a question that was asked, which I don't really know the answer to. And, you know, I don't know if either one of these guys are going to have the answer either, because we've all only covered USC, basically. We haven't been around a bunch of other teams to be able to say. But can you compare USC to Oklahoma, Bama, Georgia, and the like, and tell me if they have a similar amount of injuries at this point as USC with three season ending injuries? And three season ending injuries is unfortunate. I don't think it's anything ludicrous, though. It's not like, and Chris Trevino can attest to this, the year, because he was at Maryland the year when they had, I think it was five quarterbacks go down.
Yeah.
They had I think it was a walk-on backup linebacker became the quarterback. Or maybe it was just a backup linebacker became the quarterback after they had gone through a walk-on quarterback. It was one of the most incredible runs of unfortunate injury news for them. But that's not the case at USC, I don't think.
And the thing with, like, the Mo Hassan injury, that was just a freak thing where he was running by himself, non-contact. Max Williams already tore that ACL already, so that's always iffy with guys like that. And then Brandon Peely.
That was non-contact as well.
Yep, and then Brandon Peely. We didn't fully see what happened on that play, but that's just a freak injury as well. So, I mean, I don't if it was a string of hamstring injuries that, like, every guy is going down, then maybe you can attribute it to stretching or the conditioning, etc. But these were just freak injuries that I don't think you can attribute to anyone on the team or staff wise.
You know? Yeah, and I think you got to give, Robert Steiner an opportunity to kind of build up, you know, what he wants to establish there too. And who knows? I mean, that, you know, what kind of impact he's going to have on injuries going forward. I don't think what USC has is out of, out of sorts. It's not like, you know, just completely crazy. But what you have to have is like a system in place to make sure if one injury isn't going to kill you. So if you had a bad recruiting class a year or two ago, an injury is probably going to impact you more than if you had a great recruiting class year after year after year. If you're Alabama and you have, like, you know, the top receiver in the draft who went down with an injury, and his backup wins the Heisman Trophy and still is also a high draft pick. Like, yeah, you mitigated that injury risk pretty well by, oh, yeah, okay, so our top receiver's out. His backup will win the Heisman when receivers don't win the Heisman. Yeah, that's how you have to, like, deal with injuries. Like, you're going to get them, but how can you backfill? And if you're a place like Alabama, you're just recruiting at a high level all the time, USC needs to get back there. And then if a guy gets injured, it's not going to be that big of a deal.
Sure.
Yeah, big concern for USC if Slovis gets hurt, no experience left on the roster. And if the fortunate thing for them is that they had no offensive linemen get hurt. If they get two offensive linemen to go down, you're in trouble. Because right now we feel confident with six, maybe seven guys in there. Depending on how you feel about Monheim and Ford both playing on the offensive line at the same time. But, you know, a couple of offensive line injuries and you're going to be in trouble, because, like Ryan said, that's the area where they haven't recruited well. And so they're on the edge there as far as the injuries go on that spot. But overall, I would be more concerned with the fact that, you know, by my count, 36, 38, 40?
You said 40 at the time.
Okay. Whatever it was. Scholarship players. Now, obviously, the roster is a little bit bigger this year than the 85, and some of those guys are away for different reasons, but 40 guys were not available to participate at the end of the full team period at the end of Tuesday's practice. If this was a game week, yeah, that would be a concern. But because it's the end of spring, we're not going to risk any injury type of thing to exacerbate anything. not as big a concern there. The season-ending ones are unfortunate, but three is not anything ludicrous, I think.
Mm-hmm. We have some parents in the chat, by the way, and on Facebook. Mike Nealon said, 7-0 after the ND game. The feeling and intensity is just different this year. Player mindset has changed. And then LC Eccles followed it up with, yep, Mike, it has. So there you go. Some parents.
Very nice.
Commenting.
Thanks, parents.
In the chat. Thanks for watching. We always appreciate it.
Yeah.
But guys, any final thoughts? This is kind of the off season, the final, but May is pretty low key for both camps and just football activities. And then June starts back up again. So what are you expecting?
May's going to be a little weird because usually if you follow the team, if you follow USCfootball.com, which you all should be a subscriber. Actually, you still have like an hour or something to sign up and get 50% off an annual subscription. You make sure you do that. But the May evaluation period was always a big deal for recruiting with like coaches out on the road, checking stuff out. It's still a dead period until June 1st, I believe, right?
Yes.
So there is no – so there's – you know, spring football's over. The draft is done. Not really as much recruiting. There's all the official visits are going to be happening in June. June's going to be packed as far as recruiting stuff goes.
Yes.
So, yeah, so it might be a little – it might be a lean month. Well, we had a whole, like, lean year last year. So a lean month I think we can deal with.
Yeah, I think so. Not really selling it, Ryan, but yes. Yeah. Shotgun, any thoughts before we wrap this one up?
USC baseball picked up a win over number 18 Stanford today.
Hey, there you go. A baseball edition. A little fun
and pack. Coley wanted to point out that he was upset that there was no Bobby Steiner and the boys mentioned because he went to the concert and said it was good fun.
Oh, nice. Did they play any Notre Dame songs at Bobby Steiner and the boys concert? Not sure. Alrighty, that's going to wrap it up. Thanks for watching this episode. That's Ryan. That's Shotgun. I'm Keely. We'll see y'all next time. Bye.
Bye-bye.
When you have sports mixed with your pop culture, along with humor and celebrity interviews, your earbuds are enjoying the Rich Eisen Show.
Dan Orlovsky, are you still a Jaden Daniels is the best quarterback available in the draft guy?
I think the three things that make it stand out for me are, number one, I think his ball placement versus man coverage is the best in the draft. Every quarterback in the NFL is accurate. He's got the best on tape. Number two, most transferable stuff to the NFL. And then I think the third thing is pocket peace.
Search for the Rich Eisen Show on YouTube or wherever you listen.